Welcome to Layers, a podcast about style and how we get dressed, from Stevie Mackenzie Smith and me, Anna Kinsella. This episode's theme is movement. Stevie, what have you been up to this week, clothes-wise?
Well, I've got an update for you regarding the cowboy boots that I recently bought. They have been a success.
Okay.
I'm very, really very happy with them. I've been wearing them a lot and really enjoying the fact that they have this very satisfying kind of clip-clop sound.
Amazing.
As I walk. Yeah, so that's quite big for me this week.
I love that clip-clop sound. I have a pair of Acne pistols, which I think must be called pistols because they sound like a gun when you walk in them.
What is, I don't know what that is.
Acne
is that a description
pistols
of the shape?
Yeah, it's like the style of shoe. They were really popular about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and they still are popular, definitely. It's like a kind of a Cuban heel. I have them in suede. They're like ankle boots.
They sound great.
Yeah, they are great, but they're very loud.
But I like that. I think that sometimes it forces you to sort of live up to the sound of yourself approaching in a room.
Oh, I love it. You announce your movement as you walk in.
Totally. What about you? What's been going on clothes-wise for you?
I haven't bought anything in a while. The only thing I've bought is running gear, which isn't very interesting, but it is on theme.
Mm-hmm.
I'm training for a half marathon in the spring, so I needed more stuff for cold weather. And I got Nike leggings in a colour called Neon Oil Spill.
Slick.
Yeah, it's like a marbleized effect, I guess, in lots of different colors. They don't have pockets, sadly, but they look really cool, and I guess that's kind of what you look for some of the
time.
Where
are you putting your keys and your do you listen to music when
yes,
you run?
I have, well, at the moment I'm wearing a jacket because it's cold and that has zip pockets, but I also have a flip belt, which is a brand of like belt, which is basically just a tube that goes around, like a tube of fabric with holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you step into it and wear it on your hips, and then you can put all your stuff in it. It works really well. So I put my stuff in there.
Fab.
And then I bought a very functional running top as well. And I think that's the thing about clothes for movement. As much as this kind of cool, on-trend, athleisure image is pushed on us through advertising, it really just comes down to function.
Yeah, and that's true because there's something about the word athleisure I just find myself completely switching off. Like, it's just, I mean, I don't really do that much physical exercise other than just walking lots. So the idea of wearing clothes for that function is just never really something that I've thought about that much. I mean, I've bought like running bras in the past, although actually have I think I might have just had them handed down to me. But yeah, I'm really excited about the theme of movement. I think there are so many different ways to interpret that idea when it comes to clothes. So like we're going to be talking about dancing and being in different countries and how, you know, it can be about the way that clothes move on you or how you think differently about clothes when you yourself move somewhere else. I was recently on holiday in Venice and just the change of scenery made me want to dress like a completely new person and like reinvent myself. I mean, I'll talk more about that later, but I think that can be quite powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll start with an interview with Charlene Teo, who is a writer and a friend of mine. We're in the same writing group. Her debut novel, Ponty, which is excellent, is published in April. She told me about moving from Singapore to the UK to study at university.
I moved from Singapore to the UK 11 years ago. The world was a different place then. I went to Warwick University and I did law. Law really wasn't for me, so then I went into business publishing. Did that for a couple of years and then did my NA in creative writing.
And thinking back to 2006, so you had lived in Singapore your whole life at that point?
Yeah.
So what were your expectations of moving to the UK at that point?
I was a bit kind of flowery. I was like an airy fairy. I was really into like really twee music, like the Postal Service and shit like that. I had this very vague idea like that being far away from home meant that I could sort of like be actualized, like be like activated charcoal, like, you know, become whoever I was supposed to be. But I had no idea like what I wanted out of that. I just had these very like sort of approximations of it borrowed from like popular culture. So like in terms of like how I packed for it, I was incredibly unrealistic. I think the weight restriction is, it was like 25 kilos or something. And there was this shop that my friends and I used to be like obsessed with for some reason in like Far East Plaza and like Orchard Road, which is like the shopping district in Singapore. So basically, like, most teenagers in Singapore just like shop all the time, like window shop or shop. At the time, it didn't feel like there was much else to do.
Yeah,
we literally just shop and watch like shitty movies. Yeah, so there was this particular shop on the top floor of Far East Plaza called Trendy Zone, which is still there the last time I checked, and looks exactly the same, and more worryingly has exactly the same like exactly the same like stock, which is quite depressing but quite sweet, I guess. And they specialize in these like really hideous, now I think about it, like pointy toed patent shoes. They were really in at one point, I don't know if you remember, they're kind of like, they can be flat or they can be like little kitten heels. I packed like loads of these weird cheap shoes. And also, like, I had no practical sort of bearing of weather. So like, I just basically just packed like all my favorite things from Singapore, i.e. like tropical clothing. And then when I turned up, I think like two times in, like, we used to like, there was this weird ritual. I don't know whether it's like typical of every university town where you pay like £1 for the cloakroom. And to get to the student union to like the from our halls would be like maybe a 10-minute walk at most. And like we'd be like, oh, we're gonna save on like the cloakroom fare and just like kind of like walk to like the wherever the horrible student night was, like, mm-hmm. you know, just in like really ridiculous clothes, like party clothes. But I mean, for the first year that in the first year of university, like for some weird reason, like maybe because it was like young and really well insulated, like I didn't feel the cold very much. So like I remember like this Erasmus student, I think her name was Anna, she was telling me outside the uni, and she was like, Shailene, you always dress like it's a summer holiday. And I took that as a real compliment. I was like, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. She was like, it's like you don't feel the cold. And I was like, interesting that you should say that. No, I don't. But then after she said that, I thought about it. And then like I started feeling the cold.
What's wrong with me?
And then I started feeling like incredibly cold, and now I'm like normal.
So once you moved to the UK, did you start accumulating clothes that weren't suitable for a tropical environment? Stuff that was more appropriate?
Yeah, I did. I got really into like charity shops and like vintage shops and stuff like that. So like all these like kind of like 80s sweaters. Discovered like the many joys and disappointments of the British high street.
So do you think that your style then kind of changed? I mean, I guess it probably changed naturally during those years anyway.
Do you remember when footless tights, the look would be like a flouncy denim skirt, footless tights, ballet flats, and a fucking belt that was unnecessary. Just like this really weird low slung belt.
Yeah, around the hips.
Uh-huh, and there was also the thing with like weird tunics and like these like kind of like unfortunate looking tops that like were like basically like a cake. They were like kind of like three layers of frills,
and then like black leggings or tights.
There's always the black leggings,
yeah, that would like might not have been black enough sometimes.
No. And they just sat on this weird unfortunate part of the leg. Like, it's like, are you going cycling? Are you like pedal have pushers. You just gone too yeah. tall for this? I don't know. Like it was unfortunate. And I think in my second year, for some reason, I was kind of like, I'm all about self-expression, so I cut my hair shorter and I dyed it like bright blue, and it was like such a mistake because I couldn't skip anything, like even like those law lectures, they'd be like, Blue, where were you? And I got picked on a lot more often by like the like lecturers.
Disaster.
Yeah, but I guess it was like, it was a different time. It was kind of sweet. That was like also the time when, what was it, New Rave was in.
Yes.
Oh my god, all the really ugly things. Like people were really into like these like hideous like print slogan t-shirts with like lightning bolts in them. And like I remember like all the boys had this like unfortunate like One Direction hair. Mm-hmm. I was like modeled after the Libertines.
Yeah. When I first moved to London and I went back.
When did you move?
I moved in 2011. Moving really made my style change quite a lot. When I went back to Dublin, I a lot of the time wouldn't have access to all my London clothes. So I would end up wearing like shitty print dresses from when I was 16 and leggings and stuff, yeah. And I would feel kind of like I had regressed to a certain part.
It's like a costume.
Yeah, a little bit. It's like my Dublin uniform, mm-hmm. which is really different. And then how do you feel? I was thinking also because when I go back to Dublin, when I lived there, I wore a lot more makeup, and I don't really wear that much makeup now.
Yeah.
And I can feel that difference between like what London is like as a city versus like what Dublin is like.
Yeah.
Do you feel, or do you think Singapore and London are quite similar?
Oh, no, massively. I mean, I think that you kind of inhabit a different sort of like psychological and social space, like based on your context. I mean, like, I just came back from like 3 months in the States, like in the Midwest, right? Like in Iowa. And my Iowa self was like really different to like my London self, for example.
Yeah.
And my Singapore self, like, it's both truer and not true to who I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like you adjust and modulate your behavior as a kind of social reflex. And I guess the same can be said of sort of like how we present ourselves as well, right? Like how if you say if you go for an interview, you know, there's certain kinds of things, like I have like a ring that I wear when I do like readings, for example.
Ah.
That kind of like a good luck thing to me. And I think I read some kind of like article. I think it was quite a credible one. It was like about psychology or something, but about how like these kinds of relics and rituals actually really do have a measurable effect on like how well you kind of like do in things like that, you know, how you perform in these scenarios.
Charlene is on Twitter at treebirds and on Instagram at strangelikeness.
I can really relate to that experience of moving to a new country to study. I did, I think, a semester. It was a semester, and I lived in Massachusetts in the US. And I think that when you're someone new, you can just very easily become hyper aware of your own style and people's first impressions of you and whether it sums up who you really are. I really remember that from that time. And also, it was so cold when I was there. I moved there in the beginning of January and it was super snowy. And that was a time I really learned how to dress in very cold temperatures.
How did you approach packing for that? Did you have to buy new winter clothes?
Yeah, I remember going with my mum to like an outdoor shop and buying this really quite big, ugly puffer jacket. I mean, I think it's ugly in retrospect. At the time, I really loved it and was a real revelation to properly dress warmly.
You take it so much more seriously in that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think maybe I'd spent a lot of time as a teenager just buying quite crap fashionable coats that never really
cut
the wind out. Yeah, and well, I feel a bit self-conscious that we're talking about heat tech every episode, but this was when I learned about Uniqlo heat tech.
Yeah.
And it was very important. Yeah. I think the other thing that I remember from that time was just about how sometimes cultural differences can mean that an item of clothing translates completely differently in different countries. And I was doing lots of thrift shopping because, you know, it's so great.
Absolutely.
In the States. And I bought this really big, bulky camouflage jacket. And I'd gone on holiday for spring break with some friends. And when I was flying back, I was wearing this. And I had a really uncomfortable interaction with a border control agent at the airport. And he said something like, "Oh, you served?" But like in a really disapproving voice, like as if I was being disrespectful to veterans by wearing it.
Yeah.
I think maybe that's just quite a specific American response, or at least a response from very patriotic Americans. But I remember being quite struck by that and feeling quite bad and wondering if I should carry on wearing it and just realizing how different people's perceptions can be.
What did you say to him?
I don't know. I can't actually remember. I mean, I think for a start, this was 5 years ago. So I think I was probably less sure of what to do in that situation than maybe I might be now.
Yeah, of course.
And I think I probably felt more thrown by a sudden sense of guilt or uncertainty.
Yeah, easily swayed, I guess.
And I remember afterwards thinking, oh, should I wear this? Is it disrespectful? And I think that's a question that sometimes it's helpful to ask around certain items of clothing anyway.
Yeah.
And I think we're all becoming increasingly aware of that. But at the same time, it's always interesting, like, where does ownership come into play? And I did continue wearing it, but I think I was quite affected by that interaction.
These are things that the study abroad handbook does not address.
That is a very good point. Completely.
You have to figure them out.
Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, well, I moved to London to study originally, and I kind of thought I would be here for longer than a year, and as it turns out, it's been much longer. But I do think the packing and moving for kind of an indefinite stay can really crystallize who you are to some extent. I think I arrived in 2011 in London with my suitcase full of worn out Dublin vintage finds and my very old bits from American Apparel from when I worked there. Yeah. I had a lot of spandex uniform left over. And I was, you know, at that point, I was like 22 and I was changing really, really quickly, you know, as a person. And those clothes did not represent who I was anymore. Mm. And yet that was what I had brought with me. And I didn't have any money to buy new things. And I kind of felt like they were following me around to an extent, you know, geographically following me around as much as everything else. So slowly I managed to replace some of them with new vintage finds, London vintage finds. And I've gotten rid of most of the American Apparel spandex, although some of it still finds place in my wardrobe, I think.
I think that is funny how you can get used to something and not really question it anymore and then suddenly and then have a moment.
Yeah.
Like, was there a moment where, like, did you wear, or did you go to a party or something, like, in this new place and wear something and just think this isn't right? Or
yes.
Was it?
Well, kind of. I think, I mean, I moved here to study fashion and, I mean, I've always obviously taken an interest in how I dress and always wanted to dress well. But you meet people at art school at St. Martin's who dress incredibly well and who dress head-to-toe designer because they're very wealthy or because they have access to it. And I did kind of, it made me look at the quality of my clothes on a very like fabric level. And I realized that a lot of my clothes were very poorly made and I no longer wanted that. You know, I no longer wanted the fast hit of trend and I wanted more long lasting and quality things. And that's been the biggest change, I think, in terms of how my style has changed since I moved to London.
So leggings or jeans, t-shirts, runners, a scarf, so either light or heavy depending on the weather of where I'm going, and some kind of perfume, and socks. I normally have, I mean, I'm always wearing it, but I have my clattering as well. I mean, it's something from Ireland, and also I've like occasionally pretended it's a wedding ring if I'm getting hassled. My name is Sally Hayden and I'm a freelance journalist. At the moment, I'm kind of working all over the world. I've just been traveling a lot for about a year and a half or 2 years, and mainly reporting on kind of migration, conflict, humanitarian crisis sort of stuff. So in the last year, I think I've been to something like 13 countries, including Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, Sudan. The next 2 months, I'm going to Cambodia, Senegal, The Gambia, and Uganda. So my attitude towards clothes, I think, is probably different to a lot of people who do this sort of reporting. I don't want what I wear to get in the way in any sense of who I'm speaking to and them speaking comfortably to me. What I tend to wear is like leggings or jeans and a big t-shirt and like basically no jewelry, like nothing that looks expensive. And a pair of runners so I can walk everywhere that I need to walk. I was thinking about this on the way here, but like I've been in situations where, say, someone was speaking to me and they became really, particularly I'm thinking of in Malawi, there was a teenage girl speaking to me and she became like really embarrassed or ashamed. She was acting strangely. And eventually I asked like what was wrong. And she said that she was ashamed because she had no shoes and I had, you know, all everything essentially, and she had nothing and she was just embarrassed to even be sitting in front of me. And since then, I guess I've been very conscious that, you know, it's not like everyone feels like that, of course, and I meet tons of really stylish people in my work no matter where they're from, but I don't want someone to be looking at me and thinking that they need to feel embarrassed about themselves, you know, and what they have. It's kind of like an anti-fashion role, but I guess it depends where I am. Like if you're interviewing officials, you have to dress up a bit because, you know, they don't really like if you turn up wearing jeans and a t-shirt, but normally I actually wear the same thing for everybody. There have been countries where I've had to change what I wear. Like I was in Sudan in July and it's quite strict, like Islamic law, and I didn't realize, but in rural areas, I had to wear a skirt, like an ankle length skirt, and I couldn't show any forearms. So I had to wear full length t-shirts as well, like loose full length t-shirts. So that was kind of a bit surprising to me, but you know, it's the way it is. I always bring a scarf, like in case I need to cover my head, or I guess it can make an outfit more formal as well, depending on where you're going. Mm. I think that I have more and more equipment. So originally I would have had a laptop, then a laptop and a DSLR camera. Now I have radio equipment as well. The amount of equipment I've had has increased, and so the amount of clothes I can bring decreases. Mm-hmm. And so I really just have to bring basics that I can wear for anything. Even this year, I've like got two more hard drives than I had before. Like, so it's, I put the equipment in the bag, then I put first aid stuff in the bag, always a bit of food. And those are kind of the priorities. It's easy in a way because you only have very limited space. So you just go, what can I wear every single day? Like a pair of runners I can wear every day, you know? I don't really want to think about shoes that much. So when you have very limited space, you just don't, you know, don't get that worried about it, I guess.
And you'd mentioned a moment ago before I started recording the, that you like to pack perfume sometimes.
Yeah, like, so I've started just bringing like a really small vial even with me. And that's because if I'm away like for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, and you're living out of a suitcase, everything just gets really musty. And so it's good to have something that smells really nice. When I'm abroad, particularly if I'm in places where there are people with very little, or, and also for security reasons, I don't want what I'm wearing or my appearance to get in the way of me doing my job. And I think particularly as a female, that means like wearing, you know, really like clothes that people don't pay attention to, like that don't draw attention to you, and not wearing anything expensive, and even security wise, like making sure no one wants to rob you. Or so in London, I'm not really that worried about any of that. But when I'm abroad and I'm on my own, like, cause I normally travel on my own, then that's something that I'd be very conscious of.
You can find Sally on Twitter at Sally Hayden. That's Sally, H-A-Y-D. And she posts links to her reporting from around the world there too, so you can have a read. It's natural to question the life you live back home when you're on holiday. Right now, I'm in Venice in Italy, and I've felt that inevitable creeping wistfulness. I'm living in the wrong place, I keep thinking to myself, when sparkling wine or spritz costs €2.50 here, and not €7.50 as it is back in London. And after 4 days of admiring the well-put-together Italians around me, I've been thinking too about how I dress. Anna and I turned over the subject of glamour a few episodes back, trying to unpick exactly what it is. Here in Venice, I've been thinking about what it is to be chic, something that I think has always concerned me more than glamour. I've found myself marvelling at both the older men and women around me, and the distinction of older is important in this case. It's their clothing I've been making mental notes of. Classically cut woolen coats, which, unlike mine, haven't pilled at the arms. Cashmere scarves in shades of lemon, light blue, or confident red. Corduroy trousers. Neat leather loafers and boots. And most of all, their enviable collection of hats. I've been considering how it would be to look effortless and perhaps, in a way, correct. After all, so many people here are dressed this way.
I've also wondered if this is even how I'd like to dress. I mean, it doesn't feel very me. What's drawing me to this look is the matter of looking polished. I think I've often strived for that, especially as a teenager, when chaotic hormones and a fast-changing appearance made me feel anything but. Now, as an adult, I associate it with being a real grown-up, sort of like an exterior signal of capability. Truthfully, though, I've never really felt polished. And what's appealing about how these men and women dress is also one of the downsides. Uniformity. Owning the same thing as everybody else isn't something I strive for. Sure, I'd love a well-cut coat and perhaps a brilliant bright beret. But I'm also drawn to items that suit my whims, like, as we know, cowboy boots, or a loud shirt. And here, whilst outwardly admiring the clothes that move around me, I've been wearing the same outfit day after day. A choice of two identical white shirts, blue Levi's and Converse. I've loved almost thoughtlessly stepping into the same thing every morning, whilst getting high on what I see around me. So I suppose my conclusion is this. I will never dress in one clear way. I will always, whether it's about clothes or daily life, swap between clear conviction and then creeping indecision. But people watching has brought me great pleasure on this holiday, and I'll return home full of ideas about things like leather gloves and the coat I'd like to button myself into on days when channeling a poised, polished Italian gentleman is exactly what I need.
When I'm dancing, I like to wear anything really, as long as I can move in it, and flat shoes generally.
When I'm dancing, I like to wear something quite tight and stretchy, but at the same time quite comfortable, and probably trainers.
I have two pairs of vinyl trousers, one in black and one in silver, and I like to wear them with my fur coat and a silk shirt that I tuck in, and cowboy boots too.
When I'm dancing, I love to wear flat shoes, preferably a really stompy boot, because I like to be able to feel my feet.
I very rarely go out dancing, so it's quite a big event. The last time I went out dancing, I wore a 1980s leather dress. It's one of my most expensive charity shop purchases. It was 70 quid. And it's so much leather, and I wore my lovely green wig with that. And I will put a heel on because I kind of want to look fabulous, and I will let my feet hurt for the sake of that. So I push it. If I'm going out, I really want to go out, because I really believe the more you dress up, the better night you'll have.
When I'm dancing, I like to wear a bra top and shorts. I feel like there's such few places in our society where we can wear really short shorts. But also, I think dance is a really nice place where you can combine sportswear and style. It's kind of one of the only physical things that doesn't have like a strict uniform, it's looser than the gym, and you can like actually experiment with adding your own personal style to it.
I mean, I'm from Dublin, and growing up, like, it would have been quite dressy when we were going out, so people would have worn like heels and dresses, and I guess I still associate that with dancing. Like, I don't know that necessarily makes you comfortable, but it's, you know, it's what I think of when I think of going out to dance.
Listening to those responses makes me sad that I don't dance as much as I'd like to.
Mm.
I love dancing, but I find that the opportunities to dance en masse are always just mostly in a club context. And I don't know, maybe it just makes me sound really old, but I don't like the fact that I have to like organise a night with my friends and then everyone goes out at midnight and then you stay out till however late, and you know, you have to lie in the next day for ages to make up for the lost time. And like, I just want to go out. I don't know if there's too much to ask. I just want to go out at like maybe 8 o'clock, dance for 4 hours, have a really great time, and I just want to be able to, you know, fit it in there and not have it affect the rest of the day afterwards.
Someone was telling me that at the Royal Festival Hall at the weekends, elderly couples have like a ballroom dancing after me.
Anna.
But maybe what we need to think about is ways that we can dance more, as you said, that maybe aren't after midnight. Although I like dancing after midnight, what can I say?
Yeah, you're a fan.
Yeah, I don't do it that much as well. But and I also get really annoyed that you do have to sacrifice your morning the next day if you stay up late. But no, I do like to go out dancing every now and again after midnight. Then stop for a kebab on the way home.
Yeah, that's true.
That's,
I think,
not to love.
Yeah, I mean, God, it is exciting, but I think that I would like to be able to do it more often. And actually, I have found a quarterly dance that I really like to go to. A quarterly dance. It does sound quite elderly, doesn't it?
1955.
It's called Lucky Cloud Sound System. And it's held in a hall in De Beauvoir Town in London. And it starts at 5 p.m. on a Sunday night and it goes on until midnight. And I went there a few months ago and had such a good time.
That sounds great.
Yeah, and it's very dance-orientated. The quality of the sound is really good, so the music sounds great. And everyone is just there because they want to have a great time. And I think that's one of the things that I find difficult about clubs, is that sometimes there are so many variables outside of your control. Mm-hmm. And, like, people who are really sort of, like, messy and inebriated and are, like,
and arseholes.
Idiots. Yeah. Just falling all over you.
Mean
and I just,
men and stuff.
Yeah, like, yeah, hands, people's hands.
People trying to steal your belongings sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So a cloakroom is always very important, I think.
What did you wear? What do you like to wear when you go to these places?
I always have to wear high heels when I go dancing. I actually feel quite uncomfortable sometimes in flat shoes, which is strange because I really like wearing flat shoes by day. So maybe it's something, I think it's something about my posture and the way that it elevates me. It's funny. And so I need that sort of feeling of like swinging in a different way. And sometimes I like to wear a skirt that moves around me as I move. Also, I sweat quite a lot when I dance because I get really into it.
Of course.
So like open armholes always. Yeah.
Get a little bit of a breeze. It's
always a breeze. How about you?
God, I don't know. I went to see LCD Sound System a couple of months ago.
I'm so jealous.
And I felt like I had a pretty good outfit. I had like a tight but not too tight, like bright blue dress, like royal blue. Maybe not royal blue. Blue dress. And then a pink fake leather jacket.
Oh, wow.
And then I had tights on and white New Balance runners, but it was so hot that I had to take my tights off.
Really?
On the dance floor.
I've had done that so much.
I was dancing, you know, and then I just kind of had to bend down and remove them.
I feel like it can be quite liberating though.
Oh my God.
You know, and also letting other people seeing you remove your tights on the dance floor. It's really just like, it really is, again, it's a manifesto.
It was humbling.
Like, I care about the music.
Yeah. It does. It gives you a new lease of life though on the dance floor because you know you've removed something, you're freer.
Yeah. And also removing things on the dance floor, I think that, like, it's not about it being sexy, it's about it showing that you're really dedicated.
Yeah, I'm not going back, you know, I'm not going to put my tights back on.
No, I am dancing, I'm getting hotter and hotter, so these things have to go.
Exactly.
My name is Joy Turk and I'm a curator. I specialise in style and popular culture.
And you have just co-curated a new exhibition.
Yes, I curated it, but it was an exhibition that's been created by myself and Saul Milton from Chasing Status. It's called Super Sharp and it opened this week at the Fashion Space Gallery.
We are at Tori's house with two very handsome ginger cats who want to get involved, so let's see how this goes. Can you just explain what the exhibition is?
It's actually a satellite exhibition or a taster, whatever you want to call it. Saul and I are working on a much bigger exhibition called Return to Jungle, which explores the sound, style and culture of the jungle genre. But I was commissioned by Lagaya Salazar at the Fashion Space Gallery to put on the satellite exhibition, which just happens to be on before the big one,
right,
which will be happening in the summer.
And how did the idea for the exhibition first come about?
So I did an exhibition in 2014 called A Street Style Journey, and it explored different tribe styles. And I got key influences to style mannequins for a selection of subcultures, for British subcultures. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Skepta styled the grime mannequin, Cass Pennant styled the casuals mannequin, and I asked Saul if he could style the jungle mannequin, because I knew about it. I knew that he collected and wore Mosh then, so he was perfect. And then when we were actually doing install, he said to me, oh, I've got 1,000 pieces. So I was like, that's just, that's like heaven. So, and then he was like, oh, I'd love the idea of doing an exhibition with it. And so we've kind of been working on it actually for 3 years. And I mean, at that time, the kind of vintage designer movement was pretty big. It was already kind of like happening, but, it's very much part of, you know, London culture at the moment, or specifically London culture at the moment. But this year seems the perfect time to actually make a big exhibition of it all.
And do you mind just explaining for anyone who doesn't know who Saul Milton is?
So Saul Milton's a music artist, producer, DJ. He's one half of Chasin' Status. And they're actually celebrating 15 years of Chasin' Status this year. So it all fits perfectly.
Nice.
he grew up, I guess, I mean, I won't say his age. I don't know. But, you know, he grew up loving jungle.
Was around
at the
time.
Yeah. Well, just about. Yeah. I mean, he grew up loving jungle, and that it was those experiences in the kind of, I guess, the later jungle years that he dreamt of being a DJ and everything. And then obviously drum and bass came through, and, you know, he's very much part of the history of drum and bass, or Chasin' Status are. That was really where he got inspired, you know, going to jungle raves. And
I'm assuming that you've had a good go through his closets of thousands of pieces of
I mean, I've seen it. That will be the exciting part of the next exhibition, because we're going to be displaying the whole collection, which I think that it's possibly the world's largest personal collection of vintage Moschino.
Right.
I think the catalyst for his collecting overdrive was making a new Chasin' Status album, where he was thinking about when he was most inspired when he was younger, and then looking back at to, like, you know, his younger raving days. Mm. And then so he kind of used style as a way to get inspired and be creative as a launch pad for making music. And that's what's so interesting is, and what the exhibition reveals, is how related music and style are. So the exhibition is split into 8 sections. There is thematic, and it's sort of like an urban dictionary of the terminology that would help describe to someone who wouldn't have experienced the 90s jungle or garage scenes. For example, we have like garage girls, off-key mosh, rude boy. And so what I've done is I've asked people who were around at the time, to give me short quotes, anecdotes, testimonials describing those different terms. So I've kind of like handed the mic over to people that were actually there to try and to narrate the exhibition. Also, each section has a music track. And then there's one section that doesn't have any garments, but just has the photos. And that section is the bravado section, because what a static garment can't tell is something that the photographs can. Mm. So I found a photographer called Tristan O'Neill through a lovely guy called Brian Bell Fortune, who wrote a book called All Crew Must Big Up, which is a sort of seminal jungle drum and bass book. And he introduced me to Tristan. Tristan was like, I've got the photos you need. I've got all the jungle ravers wearing the head-to-toe mosh and D&G and Versace. If you look at them, they just show the kind of energy, that kind of sweaty, really sort of bravado-esque energy that was so evident at jungle raves. But I just love the irony that they're just kind of head to toe in all this really expensive, you know, silk or garments, and it's just a really nice sort of juxtaposition. And so the photographs tell that so well. So that section is only photographs. The idea of subcultures and particularly the relationship of style and music isn't played out in the club anymore, or not so much. It's kind of played out on social media. That part of clubbing history is quite sacred now. Mm. That kind of pre-social media gentrification of London. It's this very, very special kind of pocket in time that's now being celebrated. People are incredibly nostalgic about. And that's what we really wanted to bring out in the exhibition.
Why do you think that dance floors as spaces can become like real incubators for fashion trends and subcultures?
Well, I mean, I guess it is a catwalk in that sense. You know, it's somewhere where you're peacocking and showing off. That's what's such a key theme in this exhibition, is the wearing of all these designer labels, you know, the actual logos on your chest, the bright prints, was all about showing off. And so more so in the garage raves, where people didn't rave so much, it was more about posing, or especially for the men, that actually you could pose with this attitude, this bravado-esque attitude, without even moving so much, because the vibrant prints and the designer leg was actually kind of part of the dance in that sense. It's part of the energy in the club.
Have you got a personal connection to like jungle and UK garage?
I guess I was a garage girl in the late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah, me and my friend, yeah, lived for it really, I guess. Went to iNapa in 2000. So yeah, for me, it is kind of nostalgic too.
What would you wear? See, I
couldn't afford any of the designer labels at the time. And even Morgan Cookeye were quite expensive to me. But, you know, we were wearing pedal pushers. We were still wearing loafers, but they were from Next, not Patrick Cox. So we had our own version of the designer version, I guess. But I would have been quite young. Mm. So it's kind of 14 when I first got into garage. But yeah, we wore not much. Gold earrings. Yeah, it was little shorts.
You know, why does this feel like the right moment to be exploring this, that moment in time from the 90s? Do you think that it feels like it's something that's familiar to people today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, again, to go back to the political side of things, I think people, there is a kind of general distrust in the government, and so people again do want to show their, it's a kind of rejection, it's a rejection of the mainstream. Because even with this resurgence, this vintage designer market that's very, very much in vogue at the moment, it's still a kind of rejection of mainstream fashion and the commercial side, because it's vintage. And so, although it's completely different, because back in the 90s, you wouldn't be seen dead wearing vintage, it still doesn't fit into the fashion, the trends of the moment. You know, it's something that has happened from the streets upwards, which has then been picked up by the labels that are being reappropriated. The original labels are being reappropriated, which are being reappropriated again. They picked up on this, and now they see value in it, because now it's all about value that they can see through, you know, hits and social media stats and data crunching and stuff. They can see that value now. Back in the day, they couldn't see that. They didn't get it. They didn't like it. You know, Moschino. So they would have hated this idea that sweaty club kids were wearing their garments in completely the wrong way. But now it's sort of being embraced.
Super Sharp runs until April 21st at Fashion Space Gallery, which is just off Oxford Street in London. Visit fashionspacegallery.com for more info. And thanks for listening. Production is by the fantastic Lucy Dearlove. As ever, we'll be posting images throughout the week on our Instagram, at layers.podcast. Feel free to email us with your thoughts, memories and stories about clothes, layerspodcast@gmail.com.
Before we go, we'll leave you with another edition of Loved and Lost,
our regular spot for stories about clothes that have got lost along the way. This one is from Sophie McIntosh, a writer whose novel The Water Cure will be published in the UK on the 24th of May by Hamish Hamilton. You can find her on Twitter at FairFairIsles. See you next time.
I am not generally a person who loses clothes. On a night out, I am the person who won't even relinquish a tote bag when dancing, a night bus sleeper who, miraculously, has always woken up with belongings intact. So when I lost my favourite coat, it felt like an outrage. Losing a coat always feels like a major event anyway. They become an unthinking part of your routine. They tie everything together. I felt disproportionately tearful when I realised what I'd done. The coat had inauspicious beginnings. It was a basic grey duster coat I impulse bought in an ASOS sale. But I saw something in it. Rolled up sleeves, a hint of Celine, 60s France. Sometimes you weren't looking for a missing part. You weren't even conscious of the lack. But then, there it was, the answer somehow, in a piece of cheap grey fabric that caught my eye. It became proof to me of a sort of synchronicity with the universe, of delight to be found where you least expect it. Soon I was wearing it daily. Where I used to see fashion as a way to stand out, extravagantly gothic in the rural town where I grew up, now I just want fashion to fix me. I want fashion to make me more myself, or rather the dream version of myself. And somehow the coat did this. It was easy, almost cheating. It made me feel together in a time where I was, quite often, a mess. It survived parties, rainstorms, holidays. I wore it buttoned up over black polo necks and leather miniskirts, over white shirts for meetings. If an outfit was too much, the coat made it not so. If an outfit was too scruffy, the coat somehow smartened it. I am not sure what kind of witchcraft went into this coat, but it was a singular magic that I am very grateful for. It was gone in a second. A Monday in spring, I was dazed, sweaty, in a rush. By the time I got to the barriers, I realised it had been left on my tube seat. I never had the heart to replace it. Possibly I got what I needed out of it anyway.